you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and hey, we have Chris Franklin on the show making his debut here on Treasury Cast. Hello, Chris.
Ooh, hello. I'm excited. I love treasuries.
That's all we needed. That's the prerequisite to being on the show, is that you have to love the treasuries. That's all we care about. And we're here because it's the Christmas season. We're here to talk about one of DC's Christmas treasuries, because of course the Treasury Edition was something that they used as a sort of way to celebrate Christmas a lot. Of course, we all know about the 17 Rudolph treasuries that DC did over the years, but they also did two Christmas with the Superheroes specials. We're here to talk about the first one, which is Limited Collector's Edition number C34, Christmas with the Superheroes, and it features a beautiful wraparound cover by the legendary Nick Carty. The cover's great, and it's got a wreath, and we have Santa, and behind Santa are the stars of this treasury, minus two. We have Superman, Batman, the Teen Titans, Captain Marvel, and no Angel and the Ape, even though they are included in this treasury. They're not even pictured on the back cover for some strange reason. But other than that omission, what do you think of this cover, and what do you think of this treasury? Like, did you have this one as a kid?
I did not. This actually came out, this was on the stands while I was being born. So, wow. I was born in December of 1974. So, no, I did not have this one. But I do remember seeing it in ads of older comics I picked up, and I wanted it. Actually, the Christmas with the Superheroes concept came to me through the Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest number 22.
Oh, great.
Which also has a similar cover. With a wreath, the Teen Titans, Superman and Batman are on it, and Captain Marvel Jr. instead of Captain Marvel. And it has that same Teen Titans story, which we'll get into how many times that thing has been reprinted.
They got a lot of use out of that one.
Yep, uses the same logo as this tabloid, this treasury. And I think I got the two Christmas with the Superheroes books that DC put out in the late 80s, the 88 and 89 one. And then shortly thereafter, at a comic shop in Lexington, Kentucky, the first one I ever went to, Comic Connection, they had this and the Super Friends treasury that you and Luke Dobb talked about.
Score.
I got both of them at the same time.
Nice.
That was a lot of treasury goodness, yeah.
That's a lot of smiling superheroes, too. You know, like, just everybody's happy. Even Batman on this cover. The back cover is some Christmas balls dangling from the top of the thing, and everybody's pictured. And even Batman is all grins.
Yeah, I always liked Nick Carty's Batman. No one drew Batman's ears like Nick Carty. I mean, there's just something about him. He's the only one that drew him like that, but I liked his Batman. So, yeah, and the one thing that always jumps out at me, there's two things. I love this cover, but it's so 70s because it's got that hot pink magenta-y cover color that was on all the Mego Batman packaging.
Oh, you're right. That is the same exact color. You're right. I didn't even think about that.
And all the $6 million man toy packaging from Kenner.
Interesting.
That color is as much 70s as avocado green. You know?
Okay. Interesting.
To me, that screams, you know, I don't know why that, you know, in particular, why this pink is so, was so in at the time, but yeah. But the other thing is Santa Claus is really short.
He is, yeah. He barely comes up to Batman's chest. That's true. Yeah, he's a very tiny Santa Claus.
Nick Carty took a right jolly old elf to heart, I guess, when he was drawing this one. So.
Yeah, it is very nice. I wish, I get the feeling that maybe the Angel and the Ape was slot it in at the last second or something, because there's no reason why they're not even mentioned or pictured anywhere on either one of the front or back covers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think they'd get on the back cover if they didn't want them on the front, because I'm going back to my digest here, but they slapped the Sandman, the Kirby, Simon and Kirby 70 Sandman on the back, and that was, I think, the same case. They had a Christmas inventory story that they stuck in each book, you know, so.
Yeah, it's a nice addition. There's no doubt about it. And so the inside cover is just basically a repeat of the cover. It shows the table of contents. It has a line art drawing of that same drawing that's on the front by Nick Carty. So we're going to get to the very first story. There's five stories in this book. It's, as I said, it's Batman, Superman, Teen Titans, Shazam / Captain Marvel, and Angel and the Ape. The first story is Batman in Silent Night, Deadly Night. So, Chris, why don't you take it away?
Okay, this is from Batman 239 from February 1972. The script was by Denny O'Neill. Art was by Irv Novick and Dick Giordano. The original editor was Julius Schwartz. Batman tracks a criminal assaulting and robbing a series of sidewalk Santas on Christmas Eve. After apprehending him, Batman takes pity on this man named Tim and follows him to the apartment he shares with his young niece, Betsy. Tim relates how Betsy's medical expenses and his lack of employment led to his criminal acts. Batman feels for Tim, but tells him he shouldn't take his anger out on the world. It's his employer who is to blame for his current woes. Unfortunately, Tim takes this to heart, and knocking Batman unconscious, goes after his former employer, rich recluse Richard Lee Evans. After breaking free of the radiator he was tied to, Batman, with Betsy in tow, begins to track Tim to Evans' mansion. They are soon snowbound. A miracle appears in the form of a one-horse open sleigh, straight from a Courier and Ives print. They eventually arrive at the mansion, only to find Tim carrying the man's limp body. Batman fears the worst, but the ill yet still alive Evans stirs. Tim couldn't finish his act of vengeance, but his threat startled the man into a heart attack. In the sleigh, they race Evans into Gotham, where he is treated at a local hospital. Batman tells Tim they'll discuss his troubles with the law later and hands him a stack of cash to give Betsy a nice Christmas. When Batman goes to see about the horse and sleigh, they have both vanished. He ponders whom these miracle providers belong to. He then looks up to the sky and, seeing the Christmas star, says, "No, on second thought, I do know whom it belongs to."
Wow. Okay. what do we think of this one?
I like this one. I think there's definitely a theme running through all of Denny O'Neill's Batman Christmas stories, which I actually did an article last year for Back Issue and about Batman Christmas stories in the Bronze Age. And I didn't even really need to do a whole lot of research to know Denny O'Neill really liked to, A, feature the Christmas star, have a Christmas miracle, and then, you know, it all revolved around the fact that Star had something to do with this amazing thing that happened resolved the conflict in the story. He did it in a story in Batman 273 and in the famous Frank Miller drawn story in DC Special Series number 21. So this is one of three with a kind of similar theme going on.
I almost wonder, in the artwork wise, like this is some of the angriest Batman faces you've ever seen. In every panel, he looks like he's ready to bite through a metal girder.
Yeah.
He is so pissed. And I have to wonder if that isn't done as a contrast to the really kind of, you know, very, you know, I don't want to say sappy, but very sentimental ending.
Right.
Just as a nice contrast. Because, I mean, like, there's, when he fights this guy out in the snow, and he's like, you'd have never taken me except I got a bum knee. And he's like, then you're the thug I want. As for your fighting, you're strictly Bush League. And he looks like he looks like he's ready to eat the guy. He's so mad. His teeth are gritted. Like, this is a really grim looking Batman. And then it turns very sentimental at the end. And I have to wonder if that's just done on purpose, because, man, he looks just pissed off.
Yeah, I liked Irv Novick's stuff. I know you and Dan Greenfield just talked about it on the Ra's al Ghul. That's what I say, Ra's al Ghul, Treasury book. But I like his stuff. It's got he did a good job early on in his Batman run of kind of emulating Carmine Infantino a bit. And then when Neil Adams became the Batman du jour, he kind of switched the style over to kind of mimic him, but he still has his own flair, you know. Mm-hmm. And he does draw a very, very angry Batman. And then some of the dialogue from Denny O'Neill, I think it's – I love the one that says, "Tranny stunts, though, and I'll chop you to cat meat. Consider that a promise, chum."
He's a trash-talking Batman, yeah.
Yeah. He is. He's just like, not in my house, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, you know, what was with DC in the 70s? Like, the story starts out with Santa in the snow, you know, down. He might be dead. Of course, he's not. And then in that Justice League story, they blow Santa up.
Right, right, yeah.
It's like, wow. And Tim actually assaults Batman with a Christmas tree, chases him into a Christmas tree lot, and then tries to strangle him with a string of Christmas lights.
So. That's a great detail. That's a great fight because it's wordless. It's all just them just kicking the crap out of each other. I really think that's very well done, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really nice fight. And it's pretty violent for a code-approved comic in the 70s, you know. Yeah. I think the fact that it is silent and Batman's not making quips and Tim's not, you know, saying anything makes it even more... seem more sincere, seems more, you know, urgent, and it's really well done. I thought it's kind of funny though that Batman, he sets Tim on his plan for revenge. He's like, "Don't take your anger out on the world. Go kill that old guy that canned you." It's like, "Oh, you might want to, you know, reconsider that." I also think it's kind of funny that Tim seemed genuinely surprised that Batman's going to run him in for, you know, assaulting Santa Clauses and stealing their money. I mean,
yeah.
But yeah, I really, you know, I like this one. I think it's interesting that Batman gives him a week before he's going to take him in and have him answer for what he's done. I mean, can you imagine the uber-obsessed Batman of today doing that?
Yeah, no, yeah. Another detail that's funny that you would never see today is that when the Batmobile gets stuck in the snow, because basically it's just a regular car for the most part. Nowadays, he would have some sophisticated, well, this can melt snow and also levitate and also do this and that. His car just gets stuck in the snow like the rest of us, you know? And that's right. It's a well-done sequence, too.
Yeah, I mean, this was the very stripped-down 70s Batman living in the penthouse, even before they moved the Batcave under the penthouse. You know, he was very, I mean, he barely had his bat rope, and that's just about it. And sometimes he had a Batmobile, and sometimes he just had a souped up blue black sports car. Yeah. And that's what it is here, you know. And I mean, you know, Tim, I mean, I know Tim didn't, he had a change of heart when he got to Evan's house. But he did cause the guy to have a heart attack. But, you know, Batman's in a good mood. It's Christmas. And, you know, the little girl, he feels for him, which, you know, I understand. But, yeah, it is a nice, you know, sentimental story. And it is contrasted with, you know, how angry it is. Batman is early on, and how violent the fight is. And it's an interesting... It's a very Bronze Age Batman story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels very much like the Batman comics of that time. I mean, it's of its time, definitely. Yeah.
Very crime centric, very cop show centric. There's no villains. There's no, you know, the Two-Face doesn't show up. It's just him taking on a crook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could definitely see this done as a TV show. I feel like a lot of the Batman stories in the 70s you could have done as a cop show. You know, minus the guy in a costume, but you really. You know, plot-wise, it's not that different from Beretta or any of, you know, Cannon or any of those 70s cop shows. And this has that feeling to it. It has a little moral to it. It's got your guests. You know, you could see whoever played the little kid and whoever played the guys, guest starring so-and-so, so-and-so, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, definitely, yeah. It's got that feel. I like it.
Yeah, and Irv Novik's work holds up at a bigger size. Like, he's not somebody whose work looks bad at a bigger size. You know, he was a solid artist. So yeah, it's a good way to start the book. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So all right. Well, the second story is from Captain Marvel Adventures number 69. It's by Otto Binder and Pete Costanza. It's called Billy Batson's Xmas. Billy is throwing a Christmas. Billy Batson, of course, is throwing a Christmas party. His boss at the radio station lets him leave work early to get ready. And on the way home, he remembers he has gotten presents for everyone except Captain Marvel. After finding the perfect gift, which we don't see, a toy train starts a fire. Billy turns into the world's mightiest Marvel and puts it out. The owner of the store blames the rented Santa and fires him. Marvel agrees to fill in, but not before buying a present for Billy. Back at his apartment, Billy realizes that he can't be both at the party and at the store playing Santa. Marvel runs into the former store Santa, and when that Santa named Mike protests his innocence, Marvel investigates and sees that in fact it was the toy train that caused the fire. This convinces the owner to rehire Mike, leaving Marvel to return to the party. Billy sees his gift from Marvel is a loud necktie, and then he switches to Marvel to see that Billy's gift is a game of tiddlywinks, something too boyish for Marvel to buy himself. But Uncle Marvel loves it and starts playing immediately, and everyone wishes the reader a Merry Christmas. The end. you know, I think this is it's a light, fluffy, airy, silly little story. It's only 7 pages. I think if you were probably feeling like Captain Marvel's a little too juvenile for you, this story would definitely be of that stripe. But it's cute and harmless, and it's a fun idea of, you know, how can I be in two places at once even though I'm two different people. So it's cute, and the artwork is good. Pete Costanza, I don't think quite as good as C.C. Beck. I don't think that's a particularly controversial statement. I don't think seeing it here at a bigger size initially does. My phone is talking to me. I don't think the story, you know, gains a lot from being at a giant size, but it's cute and it just sort of passes the time in the 7 pages.
Yeah, it's charming. You know, it's got that whimsical charm about it that Captain Marvel had, and you can understand why he was so popular, especially amongst younger kids. Back then by reading this. And the artwork, it's a little, you know, especially compared to like the Irv Novik, it's a little rougher, blown up than that. And but plus you don't know exactly what they're working from either. I'm sure they have better files to work from for the Batman story since it was like 2 years old.
Sure,
or something.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a 30-year-old story they're reprinting here. Yeah.
Right. And I do think it's interesting. I always think it's funny how in the Golden Age stories, you know, they really kind of danced around just exactly what was the deal between Billy and Captain Marvel. Were they the same guy? They kind of almost treated them like they weren't. And then,
right. And
what always really kills me is how Billy will just say Shazam seemingly in front of people, and they never realize
he'll do Captain it inside Marvel. A closed room. You know, it's like, does not the lightning bolt cause fires or something like that? I mean, in Legends, right. It can immolate people, as we've seen.
Exactly. Macro Man. Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, even Michael Gray would run around to the front of the RV, you know, before he would say
Shazam. Yeah, exactly.
Shazam.
Yeah, Billy could be in a bathroom and he's like, Shazam. You're like, well, okay. All right.
Yeah. I do think it's funny that he's supposed to have the wisdom of Solomon, but doesn't realize, oh, wait, I already have a Christmas party going on. I can't be Santa Claus at the same time. Wait a minute. I have to say, I'm not really sure I know what tiddlywinks are. I kind of do, but not exactly. But
they're like little plastic things, and you flick them with one with the other, and it makes them jump. That's what
right.
My game was.
That's it. That's what I thought. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's cute, and the loud ties, you know, kind of a cute thing. It's a cute. It's a cute little story. I mean, there's if you're going to pick this thing apart, then I think you have no soul.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. It's right. It's meant. It's a nice window into something from the past, especially after the modern story of Batman. It is, you know, it's meant to be representative of DC's, you know, Christmas stories over the years. So it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, me too. I think so too.
All right. So okay. Well, the third story is a brand new story. It's new to us, as they say, like how a rerun, if you haven't seen it, is new to you. I don't have any verification of this, but because this was never printed anywhere, I'm going to assume this is an inventory story that maybe was done before Angel and the Ape got canceled. and then they just had it lying around because there's no way they commissioned a new story of Angel and the Ape here, especially since it's not even mentioned on the cover. So
I went and looked, and Angel, it was actually changed from Angel and the Ape to Meet Angel before it was canceled.
Oh, that's right. And I forgot that. You're right.
And it ended, even though the Ape was still part of it, Sam was still part of it, and it ended at number 7, and that, well, actually a lot of them looked like a Halloween cover, but it came out in like September of 19, I think it was 69, I think, and so the next issue, because it was bi-monthly, would have probably been a Christmas issue. So it,
nice
it makes...
Nice detective work, Chris.
Well, don't thank me. Thank Mike's Amazing World of Comics.
Well, a good detective knows where to find the information, though. Come on, I'm giving you a compliment. Just roll it.
Okay.
All right, maybe not Batman worth, but Robin worthy, and that's your favorite character. So there you
that's
go.
Right. There you go.
So anyway, this story is called The $500,000 Doll Caper. It's by John Albano and the Dynamite team of Bob Oxner and Wally Wood. In the $50,000 or $500,000 caper, a harried man pushes a Santa out of the way to grab a cab in a snowstorm. While the cab is rushing through the streets, it hits the car of Angel O'Day. The cab driver yells at her, leaving Angel to throw a punch, which misses the cab driver and hits the passenger, knocking him out. We learn that the man in question is a diamond smuggler on orders from a Mr. Stooge. The diamond was kept inside a doll, so Mr. Stooge tells his henchmen they must find that doll. The doll was, of course, picked up by Angel, who is on her way to the airport to pick up that Santa. Now that she's missed him, she tells her partner, Sam Simeon, the giant monkey, that they have to deliver her car full of toys themselves. As they do this, they are trailed by Stooge's armed henchmen. They follow Angel and the Ape to Santa's workshop, and they try to grab the doll. Sam and Santa's elves beat the goons up, but a few of them escape and steal Sam's car. And it is at this point that I grew tired of writing the synopsis for this story, because Angel and the Ape is like reading Mad Magazine, and I mean that as a compliment, but you try to write a synopsis of a Mad Magazine story. You're really getting the words and not the music of this. The story gets crazier and crazier. They introduce a little professor guy. There's a Frankenstein that shows up into the story. Angel gets bopped over the head by the Ape. It's really cute, but there really is not much point in getting into this gory details of the story.
No,
but it's really well done, and the artwork, as I mentioned, is terrific. Bob Oxner and Wally Wood are just beautiful. Wally Wood, one of the great comic artists of all time, and I love their little cartoon Frankenstein. It's a cute story.
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed this. This is one of the few. This is probably the only Angel and the Ape story I've read all the way through. I mean, I just didn't have any access to them,
right.
You know. And I would read a trade paperback of this. I mean, all day long, because it does have that Mad Magazine feel. I think probably because of Wally Wood.
Sure.
The early Mad, you know, the early
yeah,
Mad.
Right. Yep.
The comic version, and especially like when the cab driver is going to get in the fight and everything. I mean, that looks like it's straight out of like the Super Duper Man versus mm-hmm. Captain Marbles or whatever, you know, and you know, Oxner draws, he was always great at drawing women and very cute, you know, attractive women. And he drew a great Supergirl, and, you know, he draws a great Angel, and it's just a whole lot of fun. I mean, I do, you know, now that I know you're really good at Detective Chimp's dialogue, I would like to hear you do Sam Simeon's, some of his dialogue, you know.
His final bit of dialogue in ape language is "Ikalap yuk uga."
There's a new closing tag for you,
there
right
you
there.
Go. Perfect. Yeah, no, this is really cute. It's really, really cute. And you're right about how Oxner drew women, because Angel is cute, but not sexy. I mean, I don't mean that. She's not meant to be, and that's the way it should be, because it's just meant to be. She's just adorable. She's kind of like a Daphne, or not that. Well, we're going to hold the world there, but you know what I mean. She's meant to be cute and bubbly. It's not necessarily a sex pot, and you know, I mean, that's the artwork meant for. Like I said, the cartoon professor guy he looks like Mr. Magoo kind of, except he's got long hair. I mean, it's just really. I mean, there's a point where Frankenstein bops Sam Simeon into the ground. You know, it's all just real silliness.
The Frankenstein's name is Boing.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
there's a lot of Frankenstein and Dracula on the covers. I was looking at the covers, and there were a lot of those going on in like Bob Hope's comics at the time. And it's really strange that you weren't allowed to use like those characters in a code approved straight comic, but they used the heck out of them in the comedy books.
It's true.
It's really weird, but yeah, why isn't this an animated series?
Yeah, seriously.
Come on, Cartoon Network. You're sitting on – how many gold mines are they sitting on? You know, yeah. I mean,
this would be great. It would be a woman and an ape detectives. That's it. That's easy enough to do. Yeah, it's really cute.
Right. I love it.
This story ends on a half page, and so this feature is one of an ongoing little bonus features that they threw in, which are a Christmas quiz. And in this case, you've got Batman using some great stock art from the JLA mailroom header of him sitting in a chair asking – Breaking the Piñata is a Christmas game in which a blindfolded children smash a bizarre clay pot which spills out candies and good luck charms. In what country is it played? And then it gives you an answer on page 64. So that's an ongoing – the Superman did it earlier. So every time the Treasuries had a half page to fill, they would do these little Christmas features. And I like all this stuff because it, you know, teaches kids about like other lands and other customs. You know, it's cute. It's like a nice little thing. And speaking of a feature – it's at this point we're at the centerfold of the book, and this book comes with a superhero calendar for 1975. And boy, this thing is beautiful. It has, of course, all the calendar dates, but then it's got some really beautiful stock art. I think it's a Al Plastino Superman, Neil Adams Batman. I'm not sure of the Captain Marvel. You've got Wonder Woman, Neil Adams Green Arrow, the classic Murphy Anderson Aquaman pose. Carmen Infantino Flash, Murphy Anderson Hawkman, The Legion, and Green Lantern by Gil Kane. I love it. I want to wait until these dates line up again, and then I can just get this printed out and laminated and use it.
Yes, I've thought the same thing before myself. That and my 1976 DC calendar, I always try to check it and see if it's going to work.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I love this. I'm a sucker for packaging artwork and trying to figure out who did what and stuff. And these are pretty much the same shots you saw on those sticker sets that they had that they advertised, right. You know, like stick it all over your parents' walls or their car. You know?
Your parents will love it.
Yeah, they'll just love it. It's not like a fathead. I bet you that stuff had some serious glue on the back of it. I'm just...
Probably toxic. It was the 70s, you know?
Probably so.
We were tougher back then.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a great little feature, and it's really handsome, and I love that Aquaman's included, of course, because so rarely. It's interesting that the Legion is in there, because this was pre the Legion becoming big. Mm-hmm. You know, they were not. I think they were homeless at the time in 1975. So that's kind of shocking that they're given that level of. I mean, I know they had to fill space, but you would think they would have. I don't know. Just think there would have been another character that they would have put in there, but there they are. So
maybe this was when they were kind of. This might have been around the time they were kind of like Dave Cockrum and those guys were kind of bringing them back in Superboy.
Maybe you're right.
Maybe this was around that time. We'd have to ask Siskoid and Little Russell Herbage and the Legion of Superbloggers to answer that question. But
it's cute. It's a really nice feature. So then we move on to the fourth story, which is we talked about the oft-reprinted Teen Titans story. So, Chris, have at it.
Teen Titans in a swinging Christmas Carol from Teen Titans number 13 from January, February 1968. Script by Bob Zaney Haney, art by Nick Carty, and the original editor was George Cashton. Dig this and see if this rings any bells. Ebenezer Scrooge is a funky junk dealer who verbally abuses his clerk, Bob Ratchet. Ratchet puts up with Scrooge's gnarly ways because he wants to put a groovy new motorized... He wants to buy a groovy new motorized hot rod wheelchair for his son, Tiny Tom. Tom is paying a visit to his pop when he sees Scrooge accept cool green from associates of a Mr. Big. Mr. Big's men use a Ginchy Ray device to change the junk they have unloaded into brand spanking new expensive items like swanky cars, motorcycles, and color TVs. Mr. Big's plot is to bring this foreign junk in cheap and then reconfigure it into expensive items he can sell for duty-free scratch. Tom tells his daddy-o what he saw, but when Bob informs Mr. Scrooge, the skinflint threatens to fire him and demands he work on Christmas Day so he can keep his eyeballs on him. With his pop unable to help, Tom calls in the Teen Titans. Robin-O, Twinkletoes, Gilhead, and Wonder Chick make the scene and see a large shadowy figure totally mop up Mr. Big's men. Turns out this is Scrounge's old partner, Jacob Farley, who has split prison to get revenge on his old partner for letting him take the rap for selling dangerous, crazy merchandise. The Titans stop Farley from stretching Scrounge's neck, but the old man kicks them out. Robin makes note of how all this is very similar to that musty old Dickens tale. This gives the teen brainstorm an idea. On Christmas Eve night, Scrounge is visited by the ghost of Christmas Past, who passes, or vibrates, through the wall with fleet feet and shows Scrounge an old pic of himself and his gal pal Alice. Scrounge splits, only to meet the ghost of Christmas Present, who rises from the junkyard like a slippery eel to point toward Bob Ratchet, digging through the nasty piles of trash for parts to repair his son's busted-up wheelchair. Then Scrounge is startled by the flying, wondrous ghost of Christmas Future, decked out in a mod Santa skirt, who also brings stereophonic hi-fi sound with her. Scrounge hears talk of his death, and the only kind words said about him comes from good old Tiny Tom himself. The happening haunting is halted by the arrival of Mr. Big and his men, who wing and down the flying Wonder Chick. The other Titans charge in, and a junkyard slobber knocker ensues. The Teen Team Supreme is stopped by Mr. Big operating Scrounge's gonzo anti-trespasser device that somehow magnetizes the Titans and draws them into an out-of-this-world tower of junk kind of resembling a Christmas tree. Tiny Tom tries to help, but Big and his men grab the boy and trash his wheelchair. Uncool. Scrounge goes like mad, baby, and destroys his weirdo device, freeing the Titans. He then whacks Mr. Big over the head with a car bumper. After the Titans trounce Big's men, Scrounge admits the teen's otherworldly intervention made him realize how square he had become. The sight of Tom in danger snapped him out of his wicked ways. Scrounge then uses the junk transforming ray to change Tom's chair into a ginchy new automated model that would make Ding Dong Daddy green with envy. The Titans, the Ratchets, and Scrounge then gather above a house ad, or in this case, a special feature, and wish everyone a groovy Christmas, with Tiny Tom observing, "Bless us, everyone."
That is groovy.
That is the groovy. Ginchiest.
Yeah, the ginchiest. I mean, this is really... First of all, great job there on the summation, because that's a lot of stuff happens in the story. This really is one of the great DC 60s classics. I mean, it really is. I mean, and DC knew it because they reprinted it 1,000 times.
Yes.
I mean, it is their, you know, I mean, it is one of the few stories, I'd say, from the 60s that, like, still gets reprinted today when they do Christmas things, because they just know. This thing, it's just... It's utterly charming, and it features, in my opinion, one of the great Nick Carty art jobs of all time. And that's saying something. I mean, this whole thing is done with more kind of a scratchier line work than he typically did. And I think that gives it kind of that old-timey, you know, what's it like, almost not scratchboard. I'm trying to think of the style, but if you remove the colors, I think you would say that a lot of this artwork would look like something you would see in a Victorian magazine of, like, the early part of the century. I mean, he changed his style to fit the story. And it features all the characters doing their typical stuff. Wonder Girl in her Santa outfit. Hamina. I mean, that is just ridiculous how adorable she is. Aqualad gets something cool to do. Rob, it's just a masterpiece. It's just a masterpiece.
Yeah, this is probably like the single, this and like issue 14, that's the Quit Robin Quit, are the two best issues of the Haney Carty Titans, and it was like one right after another. This is their Silver Surfer Galactus saga almost for Teen Titans. Yeah, I love this. I've got it. I don't know how many times I've got this thing reprinted. I've got the original. I found one. It's pretty beat up, but I did get one, and I've got it here. I've got it in the digest. I've got it in Christmas with the Superheroes #1 that from 88. I've got it in the Showcase Presents. I mean, it's, but you know, one thing that I found really interesting when I got that Showcase Presents, there is a page they never reprint from this story after the splash page. There's a page of this story where it shows the Titans in their headquarters behind the Batman on TV billboard, and they're sitting around reading comics, and Robin is reading A Christmas Carol, and Wonder Girl gives him crap about it, saying, "Oh, what are you reading that for? Nothing like that could ever happen today. Nobody believes in Scrooge or Bob Cratchit anymore." And then there's a little blurb, that little, you know, Haney narration that comes up and says, "Is this story really outdated, or could it happen today?" And then you get into the Junkorama scene. So that page is, I don't know why they cut that out, because it kind of helps sell the whole idea of it happening again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow.
I never knew that page existed until I got to Showcase Presents.
I didn't either. I've never seen that page. I'm like, that sounds really interesting. Huh.
I'll send you a scan of it.
Yeah, we'll have to put that on the show notes. That's really strange. Really weird. All right. Wow, yeah, I want to get another page in Nick Carty artwork I get to look at. I mean, the layouts here are beautiful. This is the story, I'd say, that earns the notion of being printed at a bigger size. Because Nick Carty's stuff just looks gorgeous. There's this close-up of the guy in prison, the jailbird. And that wonderful close-up of him where he's, like, popping out of the panel. And, I mean, that drawing is just so well done. It's such a wonderfully realized little vignette of this guy as he's talking. "We sold some defective material. Someone was hurt on the job, and I alone was blamed." Like, that by itself is just all the scratchy stuff on his beard. It's so beautiful. Carty just killed it. Just absolutely. The lighting, everything about it is just beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, all his – the Teen Titans series is really a gorgeous looking book, because Carty was involved at least on inks in almost every issue of the original run. But I think this probably is like the single best looking issue of the run. I think you're right. It's fantastic. And I have to say this, and I might be the only person, but I have always thought, since I got this in the Digest 35 years ago, always thought that Scrounge looked like Shemp Howard from the Three Stooges.
He kind of does, a little bit. I can see that. I see what you're talking about. Okay, that's interesting.
The Three Stooges was on, like, TBS every afternoon when I was a kid.
Sure.
So I saw a lot of Shemp. So.
Yep. Yeah, it's great stuff, and it's because I think it's the longest story in the book, because this is like a full-lengther that it's sort of the centerpiece of the whole Treasury edition. So it's really very beautiful. And again, more Wonder Girl in that Santa outfit.
Wow. Oh, wow. You know, and I feel kind of bad about that, because she can't be, like, over, like, 16, but Carty draws her much older than that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't feel so bad. I mean, there's even a fairly gratuitous butt shot as she's flying through the air.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
But, yeah, he always drew a great Wonder Girl. And, I mean, I've always just been a sucker for, you know, his version of the Titans and Haney, you know, I mean, really, this, how many times has the Scrooge story been, they're Scrooged, you know, obviously, which is in a way, you know, very similar, because the Christmas Carol story exists in the Teen Titans universe,
right,
and it exists in the Scrooged universe, but yet it's happening again, you know, and so it's kind of uses the same conceit. So, of course, Robin gets the idea, and that, of course, all the ghosts and stuff are fake in this one, because it's the Titans dressed up as the ghost. But the only thing that's, of course, the dialogue and stuff is the typical Haney, teen speak. Mm-hmm. But the most Haney-like thing in this is, of course, the junk ray is kind of out there, but the trespasser catcher thing is, I'm not really sure how that works, but
it looks cool, so it doesn't matter. Yeah,
it looks cool. It puts them all into the middle of a Christmas tree, which gives you the original cover, but who cares? I mean, this is just, I'm a sucker for A Christmas Carol in any version. It's I have to watch at least two or three different versions of it every Christmas where I feel like Christmas has not come properly.
Okay.
And I have to reread this. So, and usually the original too. So I'm a sucker for it. So this is always been, it's probably my favorite Christmas comic story, period, honestly. So
yeah, it's really, really wonderful. So and this end, again, it ends on a half page, and we end our Christmas quiz this time with Angel asking about the wearer's custom for children to fill wooden shoes on Christmas Eve with tidbits for Saint Nick's white horse. Flip this page for the answer, and then at the bottom we've got the answers for all the things. So it's really, really quite cute. So we're going to move on to the final story, and that is Christmastown USA from Action Comics 117, which was published in 1948 by Alvin Schwartz and J. Winslow Mortimer. Perry White assigns two reporters to write about the annual holiday celebration at Christmastown, slow news day in Metropolis. As they fly there, Lois Lane notices the town's river has overflowed its banks. After they land, Clark changes into Superman, who looks for the mayor. The city is now flooded, and the mayor tells the Man of Steel the celebrations are ruined. Superman says, on the contrary, and shows the mayor what he means. Superman builds an ark and plants the biggest Christmas tree imaginable on top of it and says they'll sail the ship down the river and bring Christmas cheer to the whole valley. But one of the town elders, a man named Osborne, isn't happy. His family have played Santa for the town celebration for generations, except this time his grandson hasn't shown up. But Lois meets a young man who was hit on the head by a floating log and has amnesia. The elder Osborne dressed as Santa to distribute the toys. When the young man hears the kids singing Christmas carols, it jogs his memory and he remembers who he is, Danny Osborne. As the two family members celebrate, Superman uses his powers to make it snow, presenting the town with a picture-perfect Christmas. Back at the Daily Planet the next day, Perry remarks both reporters have managed to turn in the exact same story from the exact same angle using the exact same headline. He decides to run one story under two bylines. And that is the end of this story. Okay. This is something where, and we'll post at least one page of this on the show notes. This story seems to have been in panels pretty heavily redrawn.
Yeah,
I can't prove that, but you see a lot of Vince Coletta faces here.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said about the Captain Marvel story, I'm wondering if the original artwork they had, or the prints for the artwork, the plates or whatever, were really worn down, and so they had to kind of dress them up a little to get them print, because not only reprint them, but reprint them in a larger size.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a little distracting because I kind of like some of the artwork by Winslow Mortimer, but then some of the other faces just sort of really stick out at you. In terms of how they don't really fit, especially the very last panel of Perry White looks like it was redrawn. And the story is very silly. And the whole angle of where Clark notices that he's in the plane and the river is flooding, but he doesn't do anything about it. He just fixes it afterwards. He's like, well, now that the river's flooded your town, I'm going to give you guys a great Christmas. Well, maybe you don't prevent the river from flooding it. But, okay. That's we only have like 8 or 9 pages here. We don't have time to question everything.
I couldn't get past that part. I'm sorry. I try not to be critical of Golden Age stories at all, because they are aimed more toward younger readers. But I can't. I know this was the whole angle of this was the human interest part with the grandfather and the grandson, the family tradition. But I'm sorry. The more exciting story is Superman stopping a freaking flood. change the course of mighty rivers.
Right there in the narration. Yeah. Yep.
And I know that was a couple of years later in the TV show. It might have been part of the radio show. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, if Superman had a few years, well, probably like 17 years from now, Aqualad will ride a narwhal into the in Hatton Corners in the first Teen Titans story, drill a hole in the ground and let the water out.
Yeah.
Superman couldn't do that. I mean, come on. Where's the Superman that, Superman 3 freaking freezes a lake and, puts out a fire with it. I mean, come on, let's have some ingenuity like that. It's neat that he makes an ark with a giant Christmas tree, but, you might want to use some of that lumber to make a dam. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. He's kind of acting like the Chamber of Commerce as opposed to, it's sort of funny of these five stories. It's the characters with the greatest powers are sort of given the least to do. Both Captain Marvel and Superman do really kind of silly stuff with their powers, as opposed to the other Batman and the Teen Titans and stuff.
Right. I think the line that sums it up best is Superman actually says, "Gentlemen, the flood is the very thing that can make this year's Christmas celebration the best ever."
Yeah.
Well, no, Superman, I think all the people who have lost their homes or their personal effects, you know, photographs they can't replace and, and you know, all that type of stuff. You know, I don't think they're really in the mood to have much of a Christmas celebration until you get rid of all this water.
Come on, New Orleans. You guys are better off now. Come on. Would the Man of Steel lie to you? Yeah, we're going to just move on from the story because we don't want to pick it apart too bad. It's very silly. To me, it's by far the least of the stories in the book. So,
right.
And it, you know, the artwork is kind of okay. And so it's just kind of a nice time filler. It's nothing particularly memorable.
I don't mean to be overly harsh on it. It's cute. You know, I mean, it's clearly they weren't concerned with that. And you know, I think part of it's too, because we were born watching Superman, you know, I mean, Superman, the movie was part disaster movie, you know,
towards the end.
So, I mean, we've seen him do all that stuff, you know. Yeah. We've seen him stop floods and things. So I think that's part of it, too. It's like, well, that's what you do, Superman. Go do that, you know.
Yep.
But
yep.
Maybe back then that wasn't so much of a thing, you know.
Yeah, I think Superman was more of kind of like almost like a cheerleader for humanity in some ways than he was actively getting involved in stopping things and things like that. So
right, yeah. I do think you're right. It looks like, especially like Lois's fashions are definitely redrawn. I mean, there's no pillbox hat and you know, she doesn't have 40s fashion on. She's got this strange leopard print hat and coat on. And you know, I know Winslow Mortimer was still working for DC and Marvel at the time. I kind of detect Vince Coletta too, but I mean, who knows? Maybe he did step in and touch up some of this and modernize it. DC was so crazy about touching up Superman.
Yeah,
I mean,
they never leave it alone.
Jack Kirby, you know, they reached over Alex Toth back then. So,
seriously.
I mean, yeah, you know, so they couldn't let any Superman go without. I'm surprised they didn't just paste Kurt Swan faces over top of
the
story.
So there are a couple other special features in this book. There's a one-page write your own comic page, which features two characters. It's by Sheldon Mayer, and it's two characters from Sugar and Spike. It's not Sugar and Spike, but it's characters kind of in that style. It's a black and white page, and it's got empty balloons, and you can just write your own little story to fit the, you know, you're basically doing Marvel style is basically what you're doing here. So it's a cute little feature for little kids.
Yeah, I think I kind of want to take it and, you know, do it, but I think I need to photocopy it first.
Yeah, I want to ruin your copy.
I don't want to ruin my copy. Exactly. Nobody's written in it or anything, but yeah, you can have somebody, you know, like fill the script in, and then the artist can get angry about, well, that's not what I meant, you know.
Exactly. So there's that little feature, and then there's yet another feature. There's actually a bunch of little features here. There's superhero Christmas cards, which features stock art of Superman and Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow, and some others. And I love this whole little bit. It's Superman and Batman telling us what to do. And it says, Batman says, first, cut out the pictures we've included on these two pages and mount them on the right-hand side of a piece of light cardboard from one of your dad's shirts or on construction paper, as shown below. Now, of all the characters to not talk about his dad, Batman is the one, I think. Is the most inappropriate. It feels kind of mean for the Batman. You know, he's not familiar with having his dad's shirts, of course.
Take one of the cardboard from your dad's shirt. I watched my father die before me.
Exactly. take the bloodstained cardboard and take it out.
God.
Bruce, slow down.
Oh, God.
Okay. Anyway. Then there's the other side. There's these little Christmas cards you can cut out, and it features headshots of Wonder Woman, Green Arrow. I love the Neil Adams Green Arrow. He's so stern looking, and Flash. Mm-hmm. They look so humorless. So it's cute, and you can wish people their season's greetings, Merry Christmas, best wishes for a joyous holiday season, holiday greetings, Happy New Year, or use a message of your own if you want. So thank you, Batman. I appreciate that. So a cute little detail, and it's back in a time when you were meant to cut up your comic books or draw in them or do all sorts. These things are, you know, half activity books as they are comic books. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's and I would be tempted. I know if I had got this when I was a kid, I would have made my parents little Christmas cards out of it. I know I would have. I mean, most definitely I would have. And I would have been tempted that headshot of Robin is from the the famous Carmine Institute, you know,
yeah,
Murphy Anderson, yeah, the poster where they're on the rooftop. It's the cover of Batman from the 30s to the 70s. You know, I mean, so I mean, that's my favorite like image of Batman and Robin like ever. Yeah, I love that. And I used to have a poster that came out of a box of like post Fruity Pebbles, that are, you know, like a reprint of it. So I love that. But I know I would have cut that out and made cards, and I'm sure I probably would have, you know, written my own message in really horrible handwriting. So.
It's cute. It's a really cute little feature. And yeah, if they had an Aquaman card, I probably would have made one. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There's another feature. It's Santa's guessing game, which is a little thing with some numbers and a column, and you like add them up, and it always comes out to be the number that it's guessing. It's very funny. It's a weird little. I used to play this as a kid all the time because I never knew could figure out how it works.
Right.
It's like you add the columns, and no matter what you do, you get the number at the end. It's always baffling to me. So. Cute little feature, and clearly it's something that they stuck in a lot of other treasuries because they just had it lying around. And it's because it's just Santa, you could stick it anywhere. There's no character, there's no Superman or Batman or whatever, so you literally could put it in any comic book and get away with it.
I think I saw something similar to that. I don't think it had Santa, but I think it was in that Super Friends special that was had a lot of activity pages. And,
oh, right, the regular size book, yeah.
Yeah, I actually got that from... I actually got that from Post Cereals. I won like a prize in one of the contests they ran. So I got that and some Puffy stickers one year.
The cereals have been good to you, Chris.
They have. They were. I ate the Post Cereals like crazy when I was kid.
And then the last features on the inside cover were the supervillains get a chance to talk about at Christmas. And we have little comments from Toyman, Penguin, Joker, Captain Cold, Bizarro, Luthor, and Mr. Mime all talking about that they basically don't celebrate Christmas. Mr. Mime says humbug, and Luthor talked about pulling his hair out if he had any. The Joker, of course, is nuts. The Bizarro ends with unmerry Christmas, dummies. So,
yes.
another cute little feature featuring some stock art of all the basic villains from the big characters. It's again a goofy little feature to round out this issue.
Yeah, I really like the fact that Lex says he keeps getting hair pieces from his goons and as Christmas presents.
Very Gene Hackman kind of thing to say.
Right, yeah. Otis is, I got you a new hairpiece, Mr. Luthor.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly. So yeah, that's Christmas with the Superheroes. A really cute little book. It's the first of two DC Christmas collections they did, and we'll get to the other one at some point. But so yeah, that's it. That's the book. I don't know if I had this one as a kid. I certainly had it later on in life because I've had it all these years. So, and it's a nice solid little collection of Christmas tales, and it's something DC's never given up. They still do it to this day, you know, mm-hmm. which is collecting Christmas stories all in one book. So. Yeah, it's a really, really nice little comic. Not nice, not the little, big, big little comic. So,
big comic, yeah. Big comic. In fact, I saw where one came out this week, like a new DC holiday special. Yeah, so I might have to. It's a $9.99 though. I saw the price.
Oh man, how times have changed! Wow,
it's like an 80-page giant, I bet. So, you know, but yeah, versus the dollar that this was, right? But I love this book.
And we'll say, at least DC, like Marvel did Christmas Treasuries, but their stories are not Christmas stories. They're just collections of stories with like a Christmas cover. DC at least collected Christmas stories.
Right. I've got one of those that's, I think there's like some new framing sequence where they're like out like playing, like having snowball fights or something. And they didn't have any Christmas or very few Christmas stories to fill up a treasury, but that's like, you know, they smelled money. So
yeah, DC could go back 30 years at this point and pull, mm-hmm. which they did, of course, because it said they're pulling Captain Marvel stories and Superman stories. So, yeah, it's a really it's a great comic, Christmas with the Superheroes. It's a lot of fun. So, Chris, awesome, man. This is fun to talk about. This is something, as soon as I said I wanted you to do the show, you said you wanted to do this one. It was perfect time for Christmas. So before we wrap up, three things. I have the questionnaire for you, but before we get to that, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on the Supermates podcast here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I host that with my wife, Cindy. We have a Christmas episode coming up, and I am also on the newly launched Batman Nightcast with Ryan Daly, where we talk about the post-crisis adventures of Batman that just launched in episode 2. As we record this, will be coming up very shortly.
All right, cool. All right, so What I want to ask you is what I ask any of my guests that are familiar with the treasuries is one of two questions. You can answer either one of these in whatever order you want. One is, what treasury do you think DC or Marvel, I don't want to just limit it to DC, but should have done outside of Wonder Woman? Wonder Woman's the gimme answer. And the other question is, what treasury would, just barring reality, barring sales, barring the reality of they would never do it, what one would you like to have seen?
I think the one they probably should have done. I mean, I know this stings because it's not, my answer's not going to be Aquaman.
That's okay. That will never really be. Aquaman had a rough time in the 70s, so I don't buy that he ever would have gotten one.
I'm really surprised they didn't do a Flash treasury, because as far as I know, the Flash always sold well. He managed to keep his book when all the other Silver Age characters didn't. In fact, he became a home for Green Lantern when he was outdoors. He had 100-page spectacular books, and they could have filled that up with Golden Age stories with Jay Garrick. They could have done a number of Flash treasury. So I would say that the I can't believe this doesn't exist is a DC Flash treasury. As far as what I wish they would have done, honestly, I would have liked to, as much as I love the Superman the movie, treasury that we got, I would have liked to have seen an adaptation of Superman the movie, but I know they'd had to pay Mario Puzo like $10 billion or something. But that's what I would like to have seen is a brand new, I would like to have seen it, the adaptation of Superman the movie in the treasury format for that cinematic feel.
Oh, that's a great answer. I never thought of that. That would have been like Rich Buckler drawing it or something. That would have been terrific. Him like rescuing the bus off the bridge and stuff. Oh my God. That's a great answer. Cause that would have been killer.
Yeah. And then do Superman 2 that way too. I love those. Yeah. And I'm contractually obliged to remind you that I demand to be on the shows when we get to that.
Okay, enough. It's on the air now. It's been recorded, so that's eminently reasonable request. So those are really great answers. Those are both really, really great answers. So, all right, man. So I think that's going to do it for Christmas with the Superheroes. Chris, thank you so much for doing this, man. I appreciate it. It's always fun to talk to you, and I can't wait to have you back on Treasury Cast.
Anytime you want me, I'll be here. I love them. And, every time I see them, I tend to pick them up in the wild. And I've still got, I've got quite a few, but I've got a lot of holes to fill in my collection, and I'm really digging the show, so I'm glad to be part of it anytime.
All right, thank you very much. And so everybody, stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos, and when we come back, we're going to do listener feedback.
Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
About some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Black Canary and Zatanna, together in one podcast. I'm Ryan Daly, and I've got a thing for superheroes in fishnet stockings. That's why I started Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. Join me every 2 weeks as I celebrate the blonde bombshell and the mistress of magic in their exciting adventures published by DC Comics. Power of Fishnets, available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Different characters spanning the galaxies of the Legion of Superheroes, presented across 7 comic book issues. A new miniseries as part of the Who's Who podcast. To handle this many characters, the Irredeemable Shag is bringing in a ringer, or maybe we should call them flight ringers.
Who's Who in the Legion of
Who's
Superheroes.
Who in the Legion of
Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes.
The Legion of Superheroes.
Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes.
The Legion of Super Bloggers team up to present Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes, a 3-episode miniseries in 2017, part of the Who's Who podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Long live the Legion.
now we're going to do some listener feedback. And as most of you probably remember from the last episode, we didn't have any new iTunes reviews, and I left a long, uncomfortable silence in the show to indicate that. But we have new reviews. Yay! So thank you much for these people who left us some left the show some iTunes reviews. First of all, let's go to Earth 2 Chris. There he is. He's back again. He gives us 5 stars. He says, a treasury trove of goodness. Rob Kelly and a bevy of great guests discuss one of the most fondly remembered comic formats, the treasury or tabloid comic. Collecting classic and new stories, these comics opened up the worlds of DC and Marvel to many young readers in the 70s and early 80s. The love and admiration Rob and his guests have for these newsprint works of art, love that phrase, is readily apparent and very infectious. For a comic podcast that will leave you with a treasury-sized smile on your face, look no further. Thank you very much, Chris. We have another review, a real treasure of a podcast from Diabetic Dave. He says, I love the show. I have several of these from when I was a kid. I agree with Rob. These are the greatest form of comics ever made. Thank you very much, Dave. And then finally, we have a review, Classic Comics Made Bigger and Bolder, from Victor Wachter. He says, one of the most exciting things to a young kid was to get a giant comic book. Not a thick comic, but a big comic, like bigger than your head. The kind you could lay out on your bedroom floor and feel like you could walk right into it. That's what this podcast is about. Like the other podcast the host is involved in, this is a great deep dive into a specific subject. With guests that are equally excited to be talking about these giant comics, the podcast celebrates the Treasury Edition comics format. It's fun, nostalgic, enlightening, and you should stop reading my review and just listen to it. Thank you very much, Victor. I really appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for those reviews. And now we're going to move on to some international reviews. And these were, I think, here when I did the last episode. And I didn't, at the time, kind of know how to look for those reviews. So I apologize for leaving them out at the time, because we did get them. So we're going to go through a couple of those right now. And the first review we have from Canada is from our pal Siskoid, who is, of course, a member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, who does Invasion and the Romance, Lonely Hearts Romance Comics podcast, and Hot Moo or Not, all great shows, and he left this review. He says, a treasure. I've never owned any of these comics, but the enthusiasm for them pours over the earbuds from both host and guest hosts, and as usual, Rob keeps it brief and to the point where even if you don't know the material, you get it and have fun. Thank you very much, Siskoid. I really appreciate that review. And we also have another one from Canada, from Bold Robin, great podcast for comics history. I remember the Treasury format comics from my childhood. They were oversized fun. Now everyone is used to the trade paperback collections, digital comics, and expensive hardcovers. But host Rob Kelly takes us back in time to cast light on a sadly neglected piece of comics history, when tales would be printed bigger than life, all for only a dollar. Rob's podcasts are fun. Thank you, Bold Robin. I appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for those iTunes reviews. That really does help the show get the show noticed, and it just it warms my heart to see those nice reviews. So thanks, everybody, for those reviews. They're really, really appreciated. So next, we're going to move right on to the feedback we got on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So first up is our pal Chuck Coletta. He says, wonderful episode, fellas. I've only read these stories in the trades, and now I realize I've been missing the full experience. I had the opportunity to have lunch with Denny O'Neill, humble brag, his wife, and some others at an academic seminar a few years back, and he could have not have been nicer or more gracious. Your enthusiasm for this story is infectious. I do wish we would get back to this Batman more often, as opposed to the humorless, near-psychotic hero who has come to predominate. I may have missed it, but who would Dan have cast as Batman and Robin during this era? Maybe Warren Beatty or Clint Eastwood as Batman? We didn't talk about that, and I've tried to come up with some names ever since I saw your comment, Chuck, but I haven't really been able to come up with one just yet. It's weird. I haven't had that problem with other characters, but I'm trying to think of who would be a perfect 70s Batman, but I haven't been able to do it yet, so get back to me on that. We'll talk about that. We had another comment from Edo Boznar. He says, well, it's official now. This is definitely my favorite FNW podcast, and that's not a knock at any of the other shows. I've been enjoying quite a few of them, but I'm just finding the discussions here so engaging, they always get my mental wheels turning. Thank you, Edo. That's a very high compliment, because we have a lot of great shows on the network. He also mentions, by the way, on the casting for this hypothetical Batman versus Ra's movie, while I think Christopher Lee and Caroline Monroe aren't bad choices for the Ogghouls, I always thought a slightly younger Peter Cushing or even Vincent Price would have been perfect to play Ra's, while to me, given the way Adams drew her with such a willowy physique, Jane Seymour would have been a perfect Talia. Yeah, I could absolutely see Jane Seymour, especially when you think of her from Live and Let Die, so that's a really good choice, Edo, and thank you for the comment. Ryan Daly, our pal from the network, says, what can I say? Another terrific episode about an awesome book with a wonderful guest. Dan, as usual, was a great guest for this material, bringing knowledge and passion for the Dark Knight Detective story. The whole Ra's al Ghul saga is rightly one of the best extended Batman stories in the character's long history. As much as I did enjoy the Christopher Nolan films, it bums me out that we probably won't get something like this adapted to the screen anytime soon. The art by Adams and Novick is already outstanding. I can only imagine how great it looks on the larger format Treasury scale. I have to get this one eventually. True, and thank you, Ryan. My pal David Ace Gutierrez says, Rob and Co., another great show, lads. Rob and Dan have resold me on something I already loved. Well done. Looking forward to more. Thank you, David. Martin Gray says, oh, phooey, you convinced me I should finally read this story. Maybe it'll make me like Roz, and one issue I'm missing in Comicsology. Maybe Neil Adams swept past one of those Lamb's Navy Rum magazine ads Caroline Monroe appeared in. Not familiar with those. Off to Google after this. I imagine they were in U.S. mags as well as U.K. ones. The ones with her dripping wet in a scuba outfit. Yeah, I'm absolutely going to have to check that out as soon as I'm done doing the feedback. Let me rush through to get this done. Our pal Dr. Ann says, I had this one as a kid and loved it. It introduced me to Roz and to Talia, parentheses, swoon. You guys hit all the right spots. Robin getting gunned down. Roz in the cave. Batman eventually beating up Ubu. Roz returning to life from the pit. Those images are all chiseled in my brain. But the part I love best is the sword fight. You are right that a cowled but shirtless Batman should be ridiculous, but it all works perfectly. And Talia kissing Bats and slipping him the scorpion antidote that way. That's my favorite part of my favorite part. As a kid, I could only think, wow. Thank you, Ange. Chris Franklin, once again, says, fantastic episode. Speaking of alternate realities, I'm not sure Dan and I aren't parallel universe doppelgangers because I kept nodding my head to everything he said in this episode. I remember seeing the cover for this Treasury in some of my earliest comics, and it freaked me out. Robin looked dead. Batman looked pissed. And who is this girl? And who's that creepy old guy? I picked up this issue sometime in the late 80s and have treasured it, ever since. I read most of those stories here before getting the old Tales of the Demon trade paperback, but I have to agree this cut of the story is tighter and actually works better. I was so happy to hear I wasn't the only one who saw so much Bond in these stories. I think of McCartney's Live and Let Die as the theme song to the Ra's saga. Perfect. I can just see quick cuts of the different panels to the da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da sequence in the song. And of course the famous kiss during the nice violin solo toward the end. Lee has always been my favorite go-to for Ra's, with Terrence Stamp a close second. Think about it. That would be a great... I love the idea of Terrence Stamp. I mean, Terrence Stamp being both Ra's al Ghul and General Zod is a little too much for my nerd brain to handle, but that's a great pick, Chris. But he also says, but Carolyn Monroe is a perfect Talia. As a hammer guy, I approve. Anytime Dan wants to talk Batman, you let him, Kelly. Okay, Chris, good to know. Like I said, Dan regularly threatens me with 13th dimension assignments if I don't give him certain choice cuts on the Treasury cast, so the fix is in, as they say. Michael Bailey from Too Many Podcasts to Mention says, first, thanks for keeping me company at the gym. I was wondering what I would listen to in my effort to distract myself from the cardio, and you and Dan provided me with a fun conversation. Feel free to use this as a pull quote. Better than cardio, Michael Bailey. Thank you, Michael. In all seriousness, I love this show, like, a lot. You can really tell Rob loves these books, and that enthusiasm is infectious. That word again. So infectious, there's that word again. I have found myself searching eBay after each episode, hoping to find an inexpensive copy of that episode's subject. Usually I come away defeated because, my God in heaven, do people want some money for these treasuries. There's another pull quote for you. Makes me want to spend money, Michael Bailey. Thank you, Michael. Yes, I do get a kickback from eBay every time a treasury is sold, so it really does help out. So thank you. Please keep buying them. Chris Carnes says, a new commenter, he says, great stuff. I love this podcast. I really enjoy your take on these books. Growing up in the 70s, these books were a treat. I was very fortunate enough to get most, but not all of them. When the volume that reprinted Action Comics number 1 came out, the young female clerk at the 7-Eleven initially charged my dad 10 cents as she was looking at the price on the cover reproduction until he pointed out the dollar actual price in the upper corner. She was taken aback that a comic, no matter the size or content, would have a dollar price on it. That's very nice of your dad. It's very honest, Chris. To think I almost passed up getting this particular edition when it originally came out when I was 10 years old, because I already had all but one of the middle chapters in the initial comic book form already, but yes, there was something about that wraparound cover. My mom concurred and agreed to buy this one for me. Those are great stories. Great parents, Chris. Good job. And then he mentions, I gather your list of those requesting to be potential co-hosts is growing. Add me to it if possible. I hope you'll indulge me, though, for commenting on any recollections and opinions of particular editions via posts. I can't wait for the next and future episodes. Chris Carnes from Batman 66 Reviewer and Batgirl to Oracle Podcast. Yes, Chris, I am very fortunate that I have a nice backlog of guests who want to be on the show. And I've had people say, you know, I want to cover this book, this book, this book. And I don't want to get too far ahead. I don't want to have, like, every treasury spoken for. But it's very heartening, and it makes me feel great to have people that want to do the show and want to do the show with me to talk about a particular book. So if there is – this is a message to you, Chris, and to anyone else who's listening. If there is a particular volume that you want to find, you can email the show at firewaterpodcast.com or firewaterpodcast@comcast.net, or you can send that, leave a comment, or you can contact me on Facebook or on Twitter and let me know what book it is you want to cover. And if it's something nobody's spoken for yet, we'll do it. So thank you, Chris, for the comment. Siskoid left another comment where he says, another great episode. The love just shines through. Zoom Yukinori says, great show, gentlemen. My thanks. I remember hearing Neil Adam explain about the inspiration for Christopher Lee and the Dracula cape during a Kevin Smith Fat Man on Batman interview over a year ago. And while I envision Batman practicing with the cape in front of the mirror, I also picture him a moment later starting to look disappointedly at his stomach, sucking his gut in, and reenacting the Mr. Bean skit where Bean is preparing himself to meet the Queen, because that is where my mind goes sometimes. Jimmy McGlinchey says, another great episode, Rob. When I first encountered Roz in the Batman comics, which had probably been around the Contagion Legacy period, I was not overly impressed. However, when I read the TBB of the O'Neill stories from the beginning, I saw what you and Dan were bringing across in your podcast, the cinematic James Bond-like qualities of the story. Although, like yourselves, it was really the Neil Adams-drawn stories which had the bigger impact. Stories drawn by other artists paled in comparison to those drawn by Adams. Yeah, well, it's Neil Adams. Hard to beat that. So thanks, everybody, for the comments on the website, which is, of course, fireandwaterpodcast.com. I really appreciate it, and please keep them coming. We also did get some comments over on the Facebook page for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Scott Rowland says, now that was a story worthy of the format! Exclamation mark. Short and sweet. Thanks, Scott. Gord Tolton says, I was never able to get this treasury, but I have great memories of the original stories. My secret origin with Batman is with the 66 series in local reruns, and I think the odd Infantino new look here and there, but during one of those summer runs of the series on my local TV station, 9-year-old me collected my Canadian dimes and nickels and decided to become a Batman reader in full. I went to the newsstand, bought a copy of the title, opened it up, and saw the bare shirt bats in the desert duel with this Roz character. I was mature enough to realize this was a Batman for a modern age, and I think at that point I realized this was a fluid character that could work in many different kinds of stories. In a confession, after Batman Forever came out, one of my first online postings was a plea for Roz as a villain for the next movie and cast Sean Connery. This also resulted in one of my first online skewerings. But after the disaster of Arnie Freeze and Uma Ivy, I stand by my choice. And Ra's al Ghul from the Scots mouth of Connery would have been as good as anything we got from a whispering Irish Liam. Yeah, I think Sean Connery actually would have been a really fine choice. Maybe like a 70s Connery post-Bond Connery, but kind of pre when he, you know, grew the mustache and this. I don't know. Yeah, I think that's a fine choice. I mean, I still think Dan's choice of Christopher Lee is the best one, but Sean Connery's absolutely a good idea. And then we have a comment from Andrew Leyland. Very enjoyable episode. I first read The Daughter of the Demon in a British annual as a kid, and that first page with Robin being shot haunted me. Yeah, hell of a way to open a story. So thanks, guys, for the comments on Facebook. And once again, keep them coming. We really appreciate it. And finally, we're going to wrap up with Twitter. We got retweets and likes from a bunch of people, and I really appreciate it. So in case I left anyone out, please let me know, and I will include you in a later episode. But we got retweets. This is a list of people I got retweets from. World Spine, Siskoid, R. Inclin 101, 13th Dimension, BTB Blog, Comic Reflection, Mountain Flower 1, Classic JLA, Longbox Crusade, DSNRS, Chuck Rod 75, Tuku Deka, MW Cronenberg, Barry Reese Pulp, Geek Tweeters, Knowing Flame, Coffee and Comics Blog, and we got likes from Kyle Benning Art, Mr. 80s Guy, Bold Outlaw, Jim Bow 32, Maxo Romero, Eric Handy, Jen 64 Sen, KRS Jams, CJ Long Chris. So thanks everybody for retweeting and liking and getting it all out there when it came out. And a big thanks to Dan Greenfield, who wrote an article on 13th Dimension about this very comic. That was a great plug, and I love having the show mentioned on the great site, which is 13thdimension.com. I really enjoy writing for it, and I really enjoy talking to Dan, as you can tell from the episode. So thanks everybody. Oh, one last thing I do want to follow up on is that in the comments, Chris Franklin talked about, and Chris Carnes talked about, that there was apparently a photo of Bob Kane holding this Treasury comic, and none of us could find it on Google, and then Chris dug it up. It was in a book at the making of the Batman movie from 1989, and he then posted it on the comments page, again, which you can find on fireandwaterpodcast.com, and there it is, a big shot of Bob Kane in a overcoat and a hat holding the Treasury under his arm. It's a great photo. It's really, really cool to see. You know, I love photos of the Treasuries sort of in real life. You don't have that many. I have a couple from my childhood, but and you know what, if any of you have books like that, pictures like that of yourself enjoying a Treasury, or you find one, send it along, send it into the show, because I would love to post those. I am going to eventually do a sort of reboot of the treasurycomics.com website. Right now it's still the old version. I am going to reboot it at some point, and I would love to add like a gallery of photos of Treasuries IRL, as the kids say. So if you have them, please send them in. So thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Chris, for doing the episode with me. I hope we had a lot of fun. We'll be doing another episode in just a couple of weeks. And I hope everybody has a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday and a Happy New Year. And we will see you soon. So until then, I hope you all get some Treasuries for Christmas, one way or the other. So until the next episode, go big or go home.
A mother told her little boy to go into the parlor and turn on television. He was distracting the mother. And he turned the dial, and he caught a picture of me on television. He ran out, said to his mother, "Ma, Superman." Well, here is Superman in a new costume with even a new title tonight, Superman and Christmas. What has Superman got to do with Christmas? You know what Superman does, Batman. And then these men, we have mother planets. Isn't it interesting how many of those we have in our world today who, first of all, seem to come from somewhere else, just as Superman does. And quickly, he changes his costume. He puts on, he goes into a telephone booth or a closet, just as an ordinary mortal. And he puts on the form and the habit of Superman. And then once he's broke through with this great power of his, then he begins to do wonders. He relieves us in our afflictions, helps damsels in distress, defends those who have been persecuted, lover of the poor and the socially disinherited. And this intensely pleases the American people.